Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and welcome to the Mark Steiner Show and our weekly segment, Soundbites. Soundbites here, looking at the future of our food and farming system in America, which is heard here on WEAAFM, the voice of the community, that is brought to you in part by KIDA, and of course, Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. Good to have you with us. And here we begin our segment this week on Soundbites, talking about this food stamp challenge that is taking place across America and here in Maryland and in Baltimore and on the Eastern Shore. We are here with Lisa Klingenmeyer, who is Anti-Hunger Program Associate with Maryland Hunger Solutions. Good to have you back in the studio, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us by phone is a former member of the House Delegate, Cheryl Kagan, who is a food stamp challenge participant. Cheryl, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
There is life after the House of Delegates, isn't there?
Excuse me?
There is life after the House of Delegates.
There is indeed.
And Barbara Morrison, who is a food stamp challenge participant and former food stamp recipient, who wrote a really fascinating book called Innocent, Confessions of a Welfare Mother, who lived what we think of as a middle-class life, had a divorce, and she and her child were thrown into poverty and then had to address the issue with welfare and food stamps. And good to have you in the studio, Barbara. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
And the number is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, or you can jump onto our Facebook pages. We're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. 410-319-8888 is the number here. So this food stamp challenge, first of all, let's talk again in broader sense, which we have over the last few weeks, because looking at what's happening with the ag bill about what is happening with food stamps. One of the things that I was really struck by in kind of looking at this today, Lisa, is that right now the House and the Senate are negotiating the food bill. And from what I've read here again this morning, the Senate proposal would cut $4 billion from food stamps, SNAP. That would mean that 1.7 million people will lose $90 in benefits per month. What would that mean? Some of $9, that's not much, people would say. And House proposal would lead to up to 4 million people being thrown off of the SNAP program and the ability to get these benefits.
Yes, the Farm Bill right now is actually technically expired in all of the debates that were going on with the debt ceiling and the government shutting down. What wasn't being talked about is the current Farm Bill actually expired at the end of September, the beginning of the new fiscal year. So we don't have a current Farm Bill. Benefits aren't being affected right now. Those are mandatory spending, but it has meant that there's been some uncertainty sort of where we're going with the Farm Bill. As you mentioned, both the Senate and the House passed their own versions of the Farm Bill. The Senate bill cuts a program called Heat Need, which we don't have in Maryland. So if the Senate bill were to be the ultimate bill that passes, it won't affect Marylanders who are receiving...
It will not.
It will not affect Marylanders receiving the food supplement program, but it will affect Maryland's ability to ever implement this program called Heat Need, which basically correlates food stamps with the LIHEAP program, the energy assistance program, which is something as advocates we'd like to eventually implement in Maryland, but we would not be allowed to do so on that bill. But the House bill is what's extremely troubling. As you mentioned, it cuts $40 billion from the food stamp program, and it does this in several ways. One of the main ways is it eliminates the ability for food stamps to correlate with other programs like TANF. And what we really want, most people say they want government efficiency. They want the governments work together. And this eliminates the government's ability to coordinate their low-income programs. So just because of that, 2 million people will lose their food stamps. But the other thing that it does is it makes it so if you are an able-bodied, single adult without children, and you're not working, you're only allowed to receive food stamps for 3 months until you get either a job or a job training program. And if after 3 months you don't have those, then you are no longer eligible for food stamps.
This is the
House bill. And that, obviously, given the economy, is extremely troubling, particularly for people experiencing homelessness who tend to often be young adults who don't have children. Their food stamp eligibility goes away after 3 months. And there's a perverse incentive because if states kick people off of food stamps for not working, they get half that money back for their general revenue. So it gives states a reason to kick people off of food stamps, to look for every case they can where someone is unable to find a job and remove food stamps from them. So that is really troubling. So the House bill is something that we are trying desperately, and we are asking folks to contact your House legislator, let them know that this farm bill, if it were to pass with the cuts the House bill has, it would be extremely detrimental, not only for families, but so many children get free and reduced price meals because their families are on food stamps. So if that bill passes, another 300,000 children will lose their free and reduced price meals at school.
Across the country. And that won't affect Maryland?
No, that one will.
Will
affect
Maryland.
The House bill affects Maryland drastically. It's just the Senate bill. The House bill has drastic impacts for everybody, every person who's receiving food stamps.
So given the state of the United States Congress at the moment.
Yes.
When will this debate take place and how is it taking place? Do you have any sense of that?
So they have appointed conferees for both the House and the Senate. So they're set to debate in this conference committee starting, I believe, in the next few weeks. The hope is that they have something passed by the end of the calendar year before we get into sort of the next budget talks. But it's getting complicated because the debt ceiling and the government shutting down and sequester, all of these things are starting to snowball together. And with no compromise kind of being given on any side, it makes the outcome uncertain.
And so let's just put this out on the table one more time. What is the average food stamp benefit a month that we know about in the state of Maryland?
In Maryland, the average person receives $130 a month, which per week makes about $30. It's $1.30 per meal.
And there are people who receive more than that and less than that.
Yes, absolutely. People receive some more, but I know more who receive less.
And so what is the most somebody can get on food stamps?
If you're an individual right now, currently, it's $200. But at the beginning of November, and that's for one person, for a family of three, the maximum benefit is $526. But with the American Recovery Act in 2009, there was actually a stimulus added on to food stamps because what we know is that food stamps are a great economic generator. For every $5 in food stamps that are spent, it creates $9 in local economic activity. So they actually increase benefits for families. And those benefit increases are set to expire November 1st. So now the average family is going to lose $25 per month from their food stamps starting November 1st.
So before we turn the show to Kagan, Barbara Morrison, it's good to have you on the air here with us.
Thank you.
Talk a bit about your experience.
Well, these days I'm a successful engineer, but when I was 24, I was in a really tough spot. My husband had abandoned me, my parents had disowned me, and I had a baby and another one on the way. I had no job, I had no child support, I had no money, I had no health insurance. So really the government was my only place to turn. I had no choice but to go on welfare. And you know, just like everybody else I knew when I was on welfare, it worked for me just the way it was supposed to. The food stamps and the monthly allotment kept us alive for a few years till I was able to work again. And since then, I've been paying my taxes. I love April 15th. I'm very happy to give back to our civic life. My kids have been working since they were 15, paying taxes. So it was a good investment. The government made a good investment in us.
So, so what was life like while they were making this investment?
Well, there were difficulties. We lived in a rough neighborhood. We were lucky to have a motorcycle gang that actually kept the peace in the neighborhood. And for someone who grew up in Roland Park, it was a bit of an adjustment for me to learn about the culture. But in fact, everybody helped each other out. That first winter, I suffered terribly because I didn't know how to make this tiny amount of food stamps work for me, or money for that matter. And so, because after I paid my rent and utilities, I had maybe $20 a month. That's all. And so I relied on my neighbors and my friends to get us through that first year.
Which is what people do who are on welfare and food stamps all the time. They rely on one another, their neighbors and their friends it's just so people can make ends meet.
Absolutely.
Cheryl Kagan, so tell me about this food stamp challenge you did and when you did it and what happened.
I'm in the midst of it now.
You're doing it right as we speak.
As we speak.
Gotcha.
I'm hungry. it started yesterday morning, and it goes for a week. We are supposed to live on $30.
How many? Who's the we?
Everyone who's statewide, who's participating.
Oh, I thought you meant in your individual case. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
So I'm an individual doing this. It is not a realistic representation of what someone like Barbara and have experienced in their past or living with now. Because it doesn't affect gas or, you know, I can go to less expensive stores. I was able to comparison shop. I've actually been to three different grocery stores to buy the least expensive products. It was interesting. I was very conscious that I was choosing items based on price rather than being someone who compares nutrition labels and looks at fat content and sodium and calories. And it really was about saving a dime and saving 25 cents whenever I could, buying generic brands. And despite all that, there's a real consciousness. I feel hungry. I'm aware of pacing my food and parsing out portions so that I don't run out before Monday morning next week.
And so why did you take this challenge?
I think it's important that community leaders and political folks understand the lives that constituents and others in Maryland and in our communities live with. This isn't just the stereotype of the impoverished homeless person. This is also, as Barbara indicated, someone who's struggling, who's threatened with losing their home, who's lost their job in these difficult economic times, and they're trying to make ends meet and trying to support their families. And that kind of empathy and understanding, I think, can lead to greater awareness and hopefully more sensitive policy decisions.
Because, well, like, I'd rather people who are taking this food stamp challenge, and a woman who is part of the University of Maryland School of Social Work wrote this whole piece on taking this Maryland food stamp challenge. And as you, I mean, she came here as a Miracle Corps volunteer, so her life is different. And you can get in your car and go shopping and do shopping comparisons. This is not a criticism, just that's the reality. But most people who are living on a limited income can't do that. I mean, it's hard for people to find. You go to one store that's close to you, you buy what you can, which is probably mostly pasta and stuff like that, so you can get through the month, Lisa.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, most people who take the food stamp challenge, the things they notice immediately is the lack of variety that you can purchase on so little money. It ends up being very carb heavy. It ends up being a lot of pasta, a lot of rice, a lot of oatmeal. Those are the things that are cheapest and you can buy in the most bulk and will last the longest. But they're things that won't keep you full for very long. They're things that won't provide you the energy you need. They're things that are not fresh. It's harder to buy fresh fruit. It's harder to buy meat. It's harder to buy protein. So those sort of sorts of things people end up lacking on food stamps. So not only do you have that challenge, that fear of, can my money go far enough, but then you also have that secondary concern of, and then am I actually being healthy? And it's really hard to be able to manage both the budget and make it last and then also purchase food that's healthy.
My guess is that most people don't think about what's healthy when you're trying to survive on food stamps. You think about what you can afford to buy and what you can get to fill your stomachs and fill your kids' stomachs.
Well, I certainly tried to think about what was healthy, but the thing I couldn't buy were vegetables, fresh vegetables and fresh fruit. A banana was a huge treat, and the boys had to split one. That first winter, my greens were the tops of carrots that I would put the carrots in water and let them grow greens again because I couldn't afford lettuce or even kale. So that was really the problem. And, of course, many people nowadays live in places where they don't even have stores that carry fresh vegetables.
As Lisa said, pasta was a key component of my shopping cart, and I wanted to put fresh vegetables in. I bought one small zucchini and a little bit of broccoli, but I had to put back the fresh mushrooms because they were too expensive, and ended up with some canned vegetables as a way of trying to get some healthier foods.
And I should mention, too, that
the person I was talking about was you.
Yes.
If you realize it was your journal I'm reading here, go ahead, Lisa.
Yes, that was my blog post. I should mention, too, that we do have some programs in place to try and increase access to fresh fruits and vegetables for low-income communities and people that are using the SNAP program. One in particular is called our Baltimore Bucks program, where if you have food stamps, you can go to most of the local farmers markets, including the large one under the JFX, the Waverly Farmers Market, and if you use $5 in your food stamps at the market, we'll give you an extra $5. So then you actually have $10 to spend at the market to increase your buying power, which is good for both the local farmers to be able to sell their produce, but then also good for the families because now they have extra incentive to be able to buy those fresh fruits and vegetables at the market. So we are trying to increase access, but that's not a program that's available everywhere.
Right, and it only hits a few people, given the numbers of people who are on SNAP and who are trying to survive, which is one of the reasons you see the lines with children and mothers and fathers and older people lining up around soup kitchens across Baltimore City to get one, try to get a hot meal or two a week. That's what people do.
Absolutely. We're actually, there's about 75 people across the state of Maryland taking the Food Stamp Challenge this year, and we've offered an opportunity this afternoon to actually go down to our Daily Bread, which is the largest emergency.
On Cathedral Street, right?
Yes.
By the Enoch Pratt Library.
Actually, it's on the Falls Way.
Oh, the one, that's right.
Yeah,
we want to keep poor people out of sight, so we put them over there.
So all the homeless services are on the Falls Way, exactly.
Sorry about the editorial comment, but that's the truth. Let's not have them down so we can see them. No, put them under by the prison so you can eat there. Nobody will see them.
Sorry. It's fine. That's an accurate statement. So we're offering the ability for challengers this week to actually go have lunch and talk to people that use that every single day as a place to get food. So it's not just something that you're doing sort of in the abstract, but meeting the people who are experiencing poverty, meeting the people who are experiencing homelessness, talking with them, breaking bread with them, and sort of sharing stories. And so that's something that we wanted people to see. So it's not just, oh, I'm hungry this week and I went grocery shopping, but to try and create as much awareness sort of about this as possible.
Folks, enjoy. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Cheryl.
No, Mark. Sorry. Just to be clear, obviously, your listeners are primarily in the Baltimore area, but hunger is a statewide problem.
Actually, our listeners are everywhere. They stretch from Prince George's County, Montgomery County, to Annapolis, to Howard County, and beyond. But go ahead. That's right. Just to be clear.
And all
over the Eastern Shore.
And a lot of folks think Montgomery County folks are all wealthy, but I can tell you that we have a lot of poverty and a lot of hungry people in Montgomery County, where I am.
No, that's true. There's not, I mean, places in Baltimore City and cities like Cambridge, Maryland, and other places are particularly hard hit when it comes to people who are living in poverty and struggling to make ends meet with food. But it is statewide. There's not a county in Maryland that's not affected by this.
Right.
Are you going to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to point out a couple of things. One of the other issues with food stamps is that you cannot buy in bulk because you don't have enough money that month to buy in bulk, which is cheaper. And so you end up buying smaller containers of things, which is more expensive. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that we're not just talking about people who are on TANF or welfare or unemployment even. When I started working, I was working as a teacher in the Baltimore City schools, and my kids qualified for free lunch. And I still qualified for food stamps. I didn't get them, but
when you first started
teaching,
mm-hmm. when you finished school and were able to start teaching. Mm-hmm. That's an important piece to know. I mean, we saw all the articles in the paper in the last week that what was it? I forget the percentage, but well over half of the employees at McDonald's who mm-hmm. work full-time there are on SNAP mm-hmm. to make ends meet.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of Walmart workers are on SNAP. Many low-wage workers, about 67% of families on food stamps are working. So it's a falsity that people are not working on food stamps. The majority of households are. They just do not have wages that are high enough to support their families on.
Cheryl Kagan, what do you think would happen if the entire House of Delegates, where you were once a member, and the State Senate had to take this food challenge and took the food challenge? What do you think it would do to change their consciousness?
Oh, I think that would be a huge enlightenment for most of them. And I think there'd be a greater sensitivity when struggling with budget cuts. I'm just looking right now at Manna Food Center, which is the nonprofit that serves Montgomery County and the surrounding area, feeds about 3,300 hungry families in Montgomery County each month, and half of those are children. So there is a great need all over the state, and I think sometimes elected officials and some community leaders and business leaders are so far removed from the reality of families that are struggling that they're not as responsive as they could be.
No, I think that's true. Folks, join us here, 410-319-8888. And as we kind of write to us here, steinershow@gmail.com, tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages. I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on this and food stamps and SNAP programs and where we need to go in this state, in this country. And many of us, many people listening to this program have experienced this themselves, and not just as a challenge, but as a fact of life. People who are just struggling to get through. 410-319-8888 is the number to join us here, and we'll take your calls. Because, I mean, so how many people are participating, you said, in this food stamp challenge?
Over 75 people across Maryland are participating in food stamp challenge this year. This is our fourth year that we've done it.
So So I'm curious how you broaden that and what it means if people do take it.
Yeah, we've over the past 4 years, we've had hundreds of Marylanders across the state take it. So we get a new batch every year. Most people take it once and have sort of don't come back and take it again. So we're always reaching new people sort of every year that we have the food stamp challenge. We invite every year all of the elected officials in Maryland to take the challenge. We invite all of
them. How many have said yes?
We've had a handful over the past few years. We haven't had an in-mass representation from elected officials so far taking the food stamp challenge. But essentially what we offer is for we ask people to live on $30 for the week, which is the average weekly benefit in Maryland. They're not allowed to take free food at meetings or free food from colleagues. They are not allowed to use food in their house that was purchased the week before. The only thing they can use are sort of spices or condiments that would last significantly longer. Those are the sorts of things you can use. And that's what people choose to live on for a week. And then we ask them to share their experiences and really use it as a platform to talk about the importance of SNAP. As Cheryl mentioned, it's not about experiencing hunger because we're not giving up our lifestyle. We're not giving up our houses, our transportations. We're not by any means living in poverty. But we're trying to use it to build a platform to talk about why SNAP is so important as a safety net program and why we need to strengthen SNAP right now and not be cutting it as they're talking about doing in
Congress. I'm going to come back to where we are in terms of with the battle going on in Congress, how it's going to affect the state of Maryland, people's lives. Barbara, I mean, because you didn't have to take the challenge.
No, I remembered very clearly what it was like. But I am doing it just as in support.
You are doing the challenge now?
Oh, yeah, in support of everybody
else. How different is it now than it was?
Well,
when you really were.
Food costs a lot more today than it did then. Of course, I live in a neighborhood where I do have access to stores, and I do have a car now, so I can comparison shop. So in that sense, it's easier. And we have the farmers markets that Lisa mentioned here, which we didn't have when I was on welfare. So it's a little different.
Because people don't realize that whether we're talking about Baltimore, Maryland, or Cambridge, Maryland, that a huge plurality of the population do not have cars, don't drive. So they either have to go on foot, or they have to take a bus, or have to take the subway, or some other way, the light rail, to find food. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who take the light rail from the inner city of Baltimore to Hunt Valley just to go to a place like Wegmans to find less expensive organic food and other food they can get home and have to grab these bags and carry them all the way back and back and forth. I mean, that's the reality for people in our state.
Absolutely, and how much time that takes and how much energy. I think one of the things people quickly realize on a food stamp challenge is that you don't have food as energy anymore. You're eating to survive, but you don't have that energy to be able to do all the things you're used to doing. And just how tiring that is to walk miles to a grocery store to carry those groceries back to your house. And then you might be going home to kids who want to play. You might have household duties you have to do, and just how tiring it is to not be getting all of the fuel that your body needs. It's just one of the many challenges people face when they are using food stamps as their sole source of ability to get food.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. I do want to thank all of you for being part of this conversation today. And so let's, really quick before we leave here, Lisa Klingemeier, what people need to know about dealing with this question of SNAP benefits in Congress right now.
Absolutely. We are requesting that folks to please, please, please call your legislator and let them know how important the food stamp program is. In the next few weeks, the conference committees are going to be getting together and talking about a compromise bill between the Senate bill and the House bill. The Senate bill already cuts food stamps by $4 billion. Any compromise that would be more than that is just tragic and is going to have real and lasting effects for Maryland families on food stamps. So we're just trying to get the message out as loud and as strong as we can that food stamps are a safety net for families and they need to be sustained and not cut.
Well, first of all, thank you, Lisa. Go ahead very quickly, Cheryl. We're about to run out of time.
Very quickly, at Maryland Hunger is a way of following this challenge on Twitter.
Oh, good.
I suspect a lot of us are on Twitter. There's also a blog, and Lisa, if you want to give out the best URL.
Sure. It's mdsnapchallenge.tumblr.com.
MDSnapChallenge.tumblr.com, and we'll also have that at the SteinerShow.org website. So I want to thank the former delegate Cheryl Kagan, who represented Montgomery County in the House of Delegates. She's now taking this food stamp challenge. Thank you so much, Cheryl, for being with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Lisa Klingemeier, Anti-Hunger Program Associate with Maryland Hunger Solutions. Good to have you back with us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Barbara Morrison, Food Stamp Challenge participant and a former food stamp recipient who wrote the book, both a memoir, Innocent Confessions of a Welfare Mother. Barbara, great to have you in the studio. Good to meet you.
Thanks
good
for having
you.
Me.
We're going to take a brief break and come back. We're going to discover here on Soundbites what's in those nuggets you eat. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to Soundbites and The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA FM, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Marvel Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, as we take our weekly look at the food system and our world and life. And right now, we're going to examine something that all of us, most of us, experience at one time or another, nuggets. We love our children. They want nuggets. We take them to our local fast food joint. We buy them nuggets. It's supposed to be chicken nuggets. But what's in those nuggets? What are we feeding ourselves and what are we feeding our children? And we have with us once again Tom Philpott, Mother Jones food and ag blogger, agricultural blogger, co-founder of Maverick Farms in North Carolina, joining us by Skype one more time. Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So, Tom, this is an interesting blog that you wrote. 40% of your chicken nugget is meat. The rest is fat, bone, and connective tissue?
Right.
So tell us what that means, what happened here? Who did these studies?
Some researchers down in Mississippi, which is an area, they're in an area of Mississippi that is one of the nation's leaders in diet-related health problems, obesity, diabetes, and things like that. And these researchers that are at a medical center and noted that they're seeing more and more cases of people with these problems. And within blocks of their facility, there are all of these fast food places. And they just noted through talking to people that a very popular item was chicken nuggets, which is a product that the fast food industry, actually McDonald's, innovated back in the early 80s. These little crunchy, this kind of burst of salt and fat hits your mouth, very appealing food. And so what these researchers did was they took the nuggets and broke them down to their elements and analyzed what they had. And they found that, in one of their samples, just 40% of it was actually meat. And the rest of it was, like you just said, it was various tissues of the chicken and fat and cartilage and things like that.
Now,
the thing about it is that people don't know that. People think they're getting little bites of meat when they buy a chicken nugget.
Right, they do. I mean, when we were talking about this show this morning, doing our morning drive show to kind of promote the show, Carla Wills, who hosts that show, said, "Well, she eats nuggets, but she makes them at home with real free-range chicken breasts, and she makes her own nuggets for her kids and her friends."
Right.
So that's different than that's what we think we're eating when we're eating nuggets.
That's right.
But we're not.
Right. And so what they're doing, the whole game with chicken nuggets is to sell them as cheaply as possible. You want to be able to make them really, really affordable so people get in the habit of eating them. And the way that you make a profit by selling cheap stuff is to, really, really lower your costs. And so I think what these companies are doing, presumably, is saying, how can we get the cheapest, the least amount of expense into these nuggets? And it's obviously a lot cheaper to buy stuff like bone and, tissue, cartilage, than it is to buy actual meat. So I think that's what's going on here.
So now this was part of a study done by a team of doctors at the University of Mississippi Medical Center in Jackson, Mississippi, which is one of the states with the biggest obesity problem in the country, leads the nation in obesity, in obesity issues. So they're the ones who undertook this, correct?
That's right. They, you know, they're saying that, you know, we're in the front lines of this crisis, and let's get a bit of a closer look at what our clients are eating.
And so when they did this, I mean, tell us how they did it.
It's a process of, you know, basically breaking something down into its constituents and analyzing it. Because different, you know, meat, when you look at meat under a microscope, it's got a different structure than fat and tissue. I mean, fat and connective tissue. So they're able to basically dissolve the chicken nuggets and then analyze what was in them.
And so when they did this, they took these samples from a couple of different restaurants, a couple of different fast food places, and they're the ones who did the analysis of what was inside the nuggets. So
That's right.
So yep. One of the things they looked at were these Tyson Foods Fun Nuggets.
Well, that was my reporting. So what I did was
So you did that. I'm sorry. I apologize.
Yeah,
that was you.
So these guys didn't want to name the
That's right. They were being objective scientists. They didn't want to name anything, but you decided we had to name some names.
Yeah, I decided to name some names, and I decided to look at this very popular Tyson product, this Tyson chicken nugget product that's marketed to kids, that is in school lunches a lot. They're literally shaped like dinosaurs, so it's sort of fun food for kids. And obviously, I wasn't able to perform the same analysis that these guys did. But what I did was I looked at the composition of protein versus fat in this product according to their own analysis, because you have to put that on food labels. So that was there. So I looked at their analysis of protein and fat in their product and compared it to chicken breast. Which is 100% meat. And the protein was way lower in the Tyson nugget, and the fat was way higher, suggesting a possibility that the Tyson nugget had a similar composition as these two samples that the scientists used. So, you know, it's a very different nutritional experience eating chicken breast than it is chicken nuggets.
And I would always say, knowing that homemade chicken nuggets taste a whole lot better, especially when you're using really good chicken. So when you called Tyson Foods, what happened?
They basically sent me to the National Chicken Council, and the National Chicken Council, which is the industry group for this particular industry, you know, they basically said that. You know, how can you just kind of boilerplate denial? You know, how can you draw conclusions from two samples? The world of chicken nuggets is massive. All these different fast food companies have their own version of it. And so they basically issued this very vague critique of the study. But, the thing is that it's true that it's a small sample size, but it's a representative sample. They went, you know, retail and bought the things and broke them down. So I think there's something to it. It would be very surprising if they got two outliers in the whole world of chicken nuggets.
Well, the National Chicken Council said, I'll read what was printed. This study evaluates only two chicken nugget samples out of billions of chicken nuggets that are made every year. It is not scientifically justifiable to make inferences about an entire product category given a sample size of two. In making chicken nuggets, our members use quality ingredients and adhere to all food safety laws and regulations to create a product with high quality their customers and consumers expect. Chicken nuggets are an excellent source of protein, especially for kids who are picky eaters.
There you have it.
So what do you say to that?
I say, like I was just saying, that I think it would be highly unlikely if these two samples were somehow outliers or not representative. I mean, they came from national fast food chains. And second of all, it's a little bit of a funny time to be talking about adhering to all food safety standards in poultry. Not that I'm questioning the food safety of these chicken nuggets in terms of salmonella, but the poultry industry right now is going through an ongoing recall out in California. It's not a recall. It's an outbreak of salmonella. And the weird thing is that there is no recall. So in other words, the company that's putting out this chicken that's tainted with salmonella is following all food safety standards. The USDA has not issued a recall. So the industry has got a bit of an image problem right now on that front. And I had to chuckle when I saw that particular phrase about food safety in their statement.
So who has done studies of anybody about the relative health or lack of it when it comes to nuggets beyond the University of Mississippi?
Well, I mean, if you look at the protein versus fat composition in those nuggets, kids are getting a little burst of protein and a lot of fat, and it isn't high quality fat. It isn't sort of omega-3, healthy fat. And so it's just another case of empty calories, calories that are not, people are gorging themselves with calories and they're not really nourishing them. And chicken nuggets are a fantastic example of that.
So when was the last time you ate a chicken nugget?
I have definitely eaten them in my life, but it's been so long. I was probably in high school.
Uh-huh.
And I don't want to say how long ago that was.
And you liked them?
I did like them. It was probably at the dawn of the chicken nugget, probably sometime in the early 80s that I was a fanatic for them.
So well, the time we have left in this conversation, folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on nuggets, eating chicken nuggets, the ones you're eating right now. I mean, they're very difficult to say no to when you're rushing around trying to pop them in the mouth because everybody loves them because they're so easy to eat. You just dip them in that sauce, and they taste so good.
Yeah, and they market them to children. That's the specific target audience for them.
And that in some ways, is the issue, is it not?
It really is the issue. It is kind of the infantilization of food. This idea that there's such a thing as kids' food is very new. Even when I was growing up, you basically ate what your parents ate. There was no, in the 70s when I was growing up, to date myself, there wasn't a whole lot of food beyond, the first stuff was Choco, Cocoa Puffs or something like that. Cereals were among the first. But in general, you went to the dinner table and you ate what your parents were eating. And maybe you turned your nose up at it, but that's what you got. And now we're living in this world where there's all this quote-unquote kids' food coming out. And I think it's infantilizing people's palates. It's making people think that, that little chicken nugget is what is good to eat.
Well, you always come up with some interesting things here. And I think that, that there's been a lot of conversations about what's in the food we eat. And I think we need to know what's in the food we eat and what nutrition is there or not there. And that 60% of what you eat probably in most of the nuggets that you buy is not pure meat, but offal and more, right?
That's right. That is right.
Offal, I love that word.
It's a good one.
we do eat offal. I mean, like to suck on bones and more, but there we are. So I want to thank you.
Yeah.
But did you want it crushed up into your meat is the question.
Right. That's right.
Along with sinew and other things. So thank you so much, Tom Philpott. Always great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Tom Philpott joins us once again here on Soundbites. Tom Philpott is the Mother June's food and agricultural blogger, co-founder of Maverick Farms, North Carolina. On his article, his blog, I should say, 40% of your chicken nugget is meat. The rest is fat, bone, and connective tissue. Bon appetit. Thank you so much, Phil. We're going to take a break for just a few seconds here and come right back with Steve Martinez, who has his Pluma Feliz Farms in Baltimore County and is a high school English teacher working with the community in Baltimore to raise turkeys for families in the city. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're about to have a conversation once again with Steve Martinez, who raises poultry at Pluma Feliz Farms in Baltimore County. He joins us to talk about his method of raising chickens here on the show the last time he was with us. He's also a high school English teacher. Steve, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really wish I could have been in the studio, but classes ended only about 20 minutes ago. So
that's okay. Yeah. You got to raise chickens and teach our children. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, sometimes.
By the way, your chickens are delicious. I would tell
you
that.
Thank you so much. I'm glad that you had an opportunity to sample one of our pasture-raised chickens.
They're amazing.
Thank you. It's very exciting to produce a chicken that tastes well like chicken.
Yes.
And not like a chalk or connective tissue.
And your chicken, they're a great deal smaller. So are grass-raised turkeys equally as small?
As what? our turkeys, we only raise them for about the last, they're only about going to be about 16 weeks old, so they're going to be a little bit on the young side. So they'll be young toms and they'll be young hens. They are raised in a similar fashion that we raise our chickens, a non-GMO feed. This time we're integrating some distiller's grain from the great people at Union Craft Brewing, who are happy enough to give us some of the barley that they use after they're done brewing. So we're reclaiming some of that waste stream that's coming out of the breweries and feeding it to our turkeys, and they absolutely love it. They're going to be a little bit smaller than maybe the turkeys that one might find, those huge frozen behemoths from Butterball in the Giant. They're going to be around 8 to 15 pounds, so they're going to be a little bit on the smaller side, but that was kind of our hope. A lot of people in the city are not having 20 or 30 people over. So we were kind of excited to offer something a little bit smaller, but still the traditional bird rather than have a chicken or a goose or a duck for Thanksgiving.
So now what does this have to do with the White Lock Community Farm in Baltimore City, that around Druid Hill?
So I was I have been lucky enough to have a lot of support come from vegetable farmers, particularly from the Baltimore Farm Alliance.
Mitchell?
Denzel from Five Seed Farm.
Right.
When him and I were working on chickens together this summer, we were running out of space because he has an intense vegetable operation up there that utilizes nearly every square foot that he can. And when we kind of were running out of space, he turned me on to Elisa and Jerome from White Lock Community Garden, who had moved to Carroll County and purchased a 14-acre farmette. And they were open, and they've been just absolutely fantastic with helping with the turkeys and chickens this year, which has just been great to have a partner in that and not have to carry all the load, teach school, take care of myself and everything else. It's just been fantastic to have them together. So Elisa and Daron are going to be hosting the pickup at the White Lock Community Garden on Sunday the 24th, where people can pick up their fresh turkeys inside the city rather than having to go all the way to Carroll County if they choose not to do so.
So the White Lock Community Farm, which is an incredible farm where people in the White Lock community themselves are growing their own vegetables. And as we've reported on with folks there, they're kind of changing the diets of generations of people in the community who are now growing their own food and canning their own food and doing things that have not happened in a long time. And it's an amazing operation to watch in that community. So now this is working with them to raise turkeys so people in the community can have turkeys for Thanksgiving that are organically free-range raised.
Well, we can't use the word organic because the government owns that word now.
Okay. Oh, they own the word? They own the word.
Well, I mean, pretty much. Like, you have to pay somebody in order to use it.
Gotcha.
So we can't say
that. So we can say free range.
We can use things like beyond organic. We can use pasture raised. and that's what we want to focus on. And particularly not free range. We don't want to use that because free range just means that they aren't in cages. So one could have a bunch of turkeys that are inside of a 100-square-foot long house that never see the sunlight, and they could be free range. But they may have never seen the sunlight. They may have never known what grass is. But they can be considered free range. So ours are pasture raised, so they're out on grass every day underneath the sunlight, and they are fed a non-GMO feed, which is not organic. Just because the cost is too prohibitive. But we are raising them for people in Baltimore, and thankfully we have 32 out of the initial 50 are already spoken for, and reservations are taken for them.
So the turkeys you raise, I mean, so we can't talk price on public radio, but these are being raised a little bit more expensive than what you would buy at a local supermarket per pound.
Probably.
Right, but they'll be between 8 and 20 pounds each.
Yes.
That'll be done through the White Lock Community Farm around Jewett Hill. The people can, yep. they can buy these chickens, I mean, these turkeys.
And they can come on down to the Union Graze on Fridays and come meet me and hear about all the turkeys. That's from 4:30 until 8 o'clock on Fridays behind Artifact Coffee in the Woodbury region.
And they can find out about just by calling you directly?
Oh, yes, you can call me directly.
At 908-433-0347.
Or I have a local number if we can give that out.
Go ahead.
It's 443-687-8997.
And we'll put that on our website as well.
Thank you so much.
But let's talk about a bit how these turkeys are different. You were talking about how they were raised. And I think this is a unique opportunity to begin to think differently about how to do that. I was thinking, as I was thinking about this is not for this at this moment. But one of the things that struck me, and we only have a few minutes left here, is that given all the empty plots in Baltimore, I could see it could be conceivable that people could grow their own. I know you're allowed to grow chickens in the city, but people don't do that. We could do more and more chickens we could be raising in Baltimore City themselves. People could raise their own chickens for eggs and meat, but which we'll be covering a great deal more. But can you raise turkeys in the city?
I have a draft of the wild and exotic animal regulations. However, it doesn't mention turkeys specifically. I would say that you definitely could raise a turkey. It's going to take a little bit more time than a chicken to raise up.
Because why?
Because they're just larger birds that take a longer time to reach maturity. Usually a chicken will reach table size in about 7 to 8 weeks, and turkeys just take a little while longer, 16, 14 weeks to get to 8 to 15 pounds. And they are a larger bird, so they would take up more space. But I love that you brought up the fact that there are so many open plots in Baltimore, and that's one of the things that hopefully going forward I would love to find a way to transition into actually utilizing some of the estimated, 50,000 acres in Baltimore that are in vacant status right now. That's a wealth of space that we could use. I mean, that's enough space to where Baltimore could theoretically produce a lot more food than it is right now. And producing turkeys or chickens on those spaces could be great. I mean, less than a quarter acre, one could produce 200 chickens easily. You could run 25 layers and have eggs for an entire neighborhood off of a quarter acre to an acre plot. I mean, which there are many spaces like that inside the city, and it would be wonderful to see that. Currently, the city has regulations that state that you can have four chickens that are over the age of 4 weeks, on any property, and then they have increments of about 500 square feet of a backyard. Or there's 500, every 500 square feet above that, you can add a chicken up to six. People, they just amended the regulations to allow people who have over an acre to have more chickens, which I believe will be a great help for one of the Farm Alliance members, Real Food Farm, who was looking to start raising egg layers next year.
So we're talking to Steve Martinez. Steve Martinez, of course, is raises chickens at his Pluma Feliz Farms in Baltimore County, also a high school English teacher. If you want interested in these kind of turkeys, you can see Eliza at Whitelock Community Farms, 900 Whitelock Street, on the west side of town, Zone 17, between 5 and 7 p.m. on Wednesdays. You can also contact Steve Martinez at 443-687-8997. Or Pluma Feliz, PlumaFeliz at gmail.com. We'll have them all on our website. And once again, Steve, great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
You're listening here to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is here on WEAFM 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and DeMarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM here for Soundbites. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio DeMarva Public Radio, is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again and to podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, find information about our guests and what they mentioned on the air today, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes now. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.